welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 228 of the podcast, and it's 2nd of August 2015 as I record this. So today we have an interview with Chandler Bolt, a young author and entrepreneur who has really inspired me this year to play a bigger game with my own business. I've been super impressed with what Chandler has achieved in very little amount of time. And we talk about productivity and how he gets so much done. I thought I got a lot done, but there you go. We also talk about confidence because I'm just, again, impressed by how he doesn't seem to have much self-doubt. And focused creation time, as well as ambition, which is something I'm really interested in at the moment, and I don't think we talk enough about as authors. Plus, the audio quality should be good this week because the various technical problems have abated. So happy about that. And we also had a good Skype connection. So on personal things, last week I told you about my new free video training series at thecreativepen.com/freedom, and it has been going absolutely crazy. I thought it would get a good response, but it has been amazing. Over 2,000 people have now watched the video, which, yeah, is awesome. And I've had lots of emails and there are loads of comments on the videos, and I'm really thrilled the information has been useful. It's, if you don't know, it's 11 ways to make money as an indie author. And you can still find that at thecreativepen.com/freedom. And I'm about to record a follow-up video on to subscribers this week on ways to actually find time to write and build a business so you can make a living from your writing. So yeah, go check that out. I also launched Deviance this week, the third book in the London Psychic trilogy, and I'm really happy to wrap that up. And I also know that everybody likes to know how launches work once you're established or in a series. So I thought I would just share what I did, because I'm sure some of you might find that useful. So essentially, I put the book on pre-order at a reduced price and emailed my pen friends, who are my list of advanced readers, so I could guarantee some early reviews. And my lovely pen friends have already been putting reviews up. But because of the change in the Amazon algorithm around reviews, and you know, they've been deleting a lot of reviews when the books have been free. So I put it on a heavily reduced price on pre-order so that my pen friends could actually buy the book as well, because verified reviews are worth more. And I had nearly 200 pre-orders. I'm still not massively enamored of pre-orders. I think they're great on iBooks and Kobo, but really not so much on Amazon. Okay, so that was one thing. I did the pre-order and also got my pen friends advanced readers ready. Then I organized promotion for Desecration, which is the first in the series. When you have a series, there's almost no point in promoting the other books. You kind of have to always promote the first in the series. But that's also good because I got a BookBub on Thursday. And of course, BookBub only accept promotions on established books with good reviews. So Desecration has like 70, you know, 4.4 star average reviews on Amazon.com. So I had a BookBub on Thursday, the day before the launch. One other annoying thing about pre-orders on Amazon is that the series funnel doesn't include pre-orders. So, but as soon as the book went live on the Friday, it kicked in. So there was three. And if you've seen how the new Paperwhite works, or the new app, the new Kindle app, Amazon actually promote the next in the series when you finish the one that you're reading. So it's a really good kind of series funnel now on Amazon. I also then had Bargain Booksy and Buck Books, lots of bees going on the Friday. So the day after, just to keep the ranking up for 2 days. Those also work much better in the US. So I ran Facebook advertising in the UK only for the week. on desecration as well, and targeted similar authors like John Connolly, Stephen King, and Mo Hayder. So that was good because it meant my ranking also in the US was good. So with those things, oh, and I also emailed my JF Pen list. I wrote a blog post on the creative pen, which was 5 lessons learned from writing 10 fiction books. And you can find that on the 31st. I think that went out on the 31st of July 2015, if you want to go read that. So what then happened? So in the US, Desecration made it to number one in Psychics, and I have a lovely picture with it next to and above 2 Stephen King books. As me, Stephen King, Stephen King. It made it to 331 overall in the US store and number 13 in crime thrillers, which was good visibility. In the UK, it made it to number 19 in crime, which is, you know, crime is a tough category in the UK. It's a big, big blockbuster category full of traditionally published books. So number 19 in crime and number 7 in women's sleuths. So that was pretty good. And in total, I sold about 1,800 books in the 2 days with that promotion. Was at 99 cents. So obviously, I think I probably still broke even, to be honest. But the aim really was to get visibility so that they will trickle through into Delirium and Deviance. So I hope that gives you some sort of ideas of what I do. And really, realistically, I'm sure you can, you know, once you book the paid advertising, you set up the ads, and I did one blog post and I sent an email. It's really not that big a deal. So yeah, I must say for fiction now, that's basically what I'm doing. I promote the first in series. So yeah, and tomorrow I will be ramping the price back up to full price at US $4.99. The other reason to ramp your price back up is that BookBub, for example, and many of the promotion sites only want to advertise a deep discount, and Kobo's the same, and all these sites. So if you don't put your prices back up, you will struggle to get advertising next time. So that's what I'm doing. I'll probably do a box set on the 3 later this year as well. Also, something that is cool and is kind of publishing news, I suppose, is that the follow button on Amazon.com finally works. So the button's been there for a while. If you go and look on your author page or my author page, if you want to have a look, JF Pen on Amazon.com, you will see there's a button under your author pick that says follow. And you should have an author page, which you should have set up at Amazon Author Central. And it used to be, it seemed that nothing happened. I mean, as soon as that button arrived last year, I clicked it on my own books and nothing seemed to happen. But now it's activated. So what happened on Friday, as soon as the pre-order went live or a few hours later, I had an email from Amazon that said, do you want to tell your followers that the new book is available? And I could write a couple of lines of text that went to people who followed the book, or at least I presume it did. So I've saved the images on my Twitter favorites. If you want to have a look, if you don't have a new release coming up soon, check out my The Creative Pen Twitter.com/thecreativepen. Click on favorites, look at 1st of August 2015, and you'll see the screen print of that little message. But basically, what I'm now going to do is put in my autoresponder series that the audience, that I'm going to ask people to actually click that follow button, because even though we should never replace our email list with dependence on the stores, you might as well use it. So any way of notifying people that your book is available is a good thing. Okay, so that's a little bit about publishing and launching. I hope that sort of extra info is useful to you. So let's get into the regular segment of what you're doing while listening to the show. Once again, featuring awesome pictures that I can't show you, but they're again on my Twitter favorites timeline. So Eva Holmquist in Sweden says she's listening to the show while clearing blackcurrant. Now, it might have been cleaning blackcurrant, and a picture of some really yummy blackcurrants from Sweden, which I love. Jaina Kirka or Jaina Kirka, catching up on the Creative Pen podcast while making tons of kraut burgers to keep in the freezer for quick dinners. And makes me feel bad, Jaina or Gina, sorry, I'm really terrible with that pronunciation. But it was a picture of a mixing bowl with loads of burgers kind of sitting there, and it looks like an industrial batch, so super cooking. Hi to Liberty Speedle, who was at the Nelson Atkins, presumably museum or art gallery, saw the Rodin sculpture of the Gates of Hell, which made me think of the creative pen. And she sent me a picture of the Gates of Hell, which actually that Rodin sculpture, it's a door, is inspiration for my thriller of the same name. So thank you for that. Jill Zero is listening to the podcast during commutes and calls it Knowledge Hour. So thank you, Jill. Brian Shea, this writer is drinking coffee with his 3D printed doppelganger and listening to the podcast. And he sent a picture of the 3D printed Star Wars figure with presumably Brian's face. Now, this is very cool. And I have seen these advertised on Wired. And I must say, I thought that would be cool. It's something I might do myself. I'm not sure about Star Wars, but if I could get like a Lara Croft figure with my face on, I would love that. So I do think these sort of 3D printed doppelganger things are cool. Derek Chamberlain, listening to the show while walking in the park on a lovely summery morning in Sapporo, Japan, and sent me some picture of some flowers. Lovely, Derek. And Japan is on my list. I have a story idea for set in Japan, probably an arcane thing or something else. Hopefully 2016, maybe 2017, but Japan, definitely. I want to spend like a month there. Very interested in that. Monica Rodriguez, listening on my commute as usual, but this time a storm was brewing. Made it home before it started with a picture of the incoming storm. Lidis Garcia says, hola, Joanna. I listen to your podcast while driving to Seattle to see my partner. It's 4 hours drive. And a picture of the lovely mountains of British Columbia. Avery Coburn says, love the podcast, just listened in the shower. Thought it best to spare you a picture of that. Thanks, Avery. And also, I had an email from our resident swimmer, Parker Hudson, and he says, this time I was listening to you while swimming. This time it was to and from the dam at Canoga, where we have been in the same cabin for 37 years. And he sent a picture, beautiful pictures of the cabin. Right, Parker, I think we're having a retreat at your cabin. That sounds like fun. James Palmer, I listened to the show while driving to and from the day job. Barry Pearman, I'm listening while pruning roses in Auckland, New Zealand. And there's a picture of Barry with his pruning shears in the garden. Now, I used to live in Devonport, Auckland, and spent 7 years over there. So lovely to see the winter in New Zealand. Alison Sip, or Sipe, says, making dinner while listening to the podcast. Congratulations on hitting your financial goals. And that looks like a lovely stir fry, Alison. Okay, so you can tell me what you do while you're listening to the show by tweeting at The Creative Pen with a double N, or you can email me, joanna@thecreativepen.com. Super duper. Okay, so this podcast episode is sponsored by 99 Designs. You can go to 99designs.com/Joanna, J-O-A-N-N-A, for your free power pack upgrade. So, as we all know, one of the best uses of your marketing budget is a professional cover. And just going back to Deviants, I love my cover for Deviants. It is brilliant. And the tattoo on the front is, you know, I'm really attracted by. So I haven't got it. It's not my tattoo, but I really do like it. So a pro cover is really very important. And you can get book covers at 99 Designs. You submit your project. Lots of designers create options and you get to choose the one you like. And there's no risk with 99 Designs as you only pay when you're happy with what is created. And you get lots of choice with multiple designers submitting work. So it's particularly good if you haven't decided on one designer as yet, which I think, you know, certainly many people start out, you know, without a dedicated designer. So that's really important. You can also get web page design for WordPress, social media banners and headers, as well as posters, postcards, flyers, email newsletter templates, t-shirts, mugs, and so much more. You can also get custom illustrations and other graphics. I've used 99 Designs myself for the custom illustration of the Key to the Gates of Hell well, which features on the cover and inside the print book. I'm also considering, because, you know, one of the things I shared, I did another interview recently. I do a lot of interviews these days, but I was talking about using stickers and colouring, and, you know, adult colouring books are everywhere, and I use stickers as kind of reward. And I'm thinking of, so many people have emailed me saying, oh, I love stickers. And so I'm actually thinking of doing some creative stickers and getting them designed on 99 Designs, maybe for Christmas time. so that we have sort of, you know, creative stickers. Anyway, it's just an idea. But those are the types of things. You can use 99 Designs for basically any kind of graphic design, from a book cover to stickers or anything else. So you can get a Power Pack upgrade, which gives your project more chance of getting noticed with bold headers, highlighted background, featured listing, by going to 99designs.com/Joanna. And that is super duper. Okay, so this corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting and transcription, but my time in producing this show is primarily sponsored by you guys. So a big thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon. And thanks especially to new patrons Henry Hyde and L.E. Thomas. And thank you also to those people who have upped their pledge since I moved to a weekly show. I really appreciate that. On Patreon, you can support me with just a few dollars or even a dollar per show, to a maximum of 2 shows a month. And you can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Okay, so we're going to get into the interview with Chandler Bolt. And just to mention that he does point you in the direction of his free video series. And if you would like to use my link, it's thecreativepen.com/school. Okay, enjoy the interview. Hi, everyone. I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com. And today I'm here with Chandler Bolt. Hi, Chandler.
Hey, Joanna, how are you?
I'm good. And it's great to have you on the show. Just a little introduction for people. So Chandler is the author of 5 nonfiction books and is one of the entrepreneurs behind the Self-Publishing School training program and the recent Self-Publishing Summit, which was absolutely fantastic. So Chandler, just give us a bit of a more of an introduction about you and your writing background.
Yeah, Joanna, you know, it's funny. I think we come from a little bit different writing backgrounds. And for me, if you told me a few years ago that I would be a writer and I'd be writing books and teaching other people how to write, I would say you're crazy. And also, that sounds like hell. Because it's funny. I'm a reformed, like, I'm someone who hated writing and hated reading. It's really weird, but I just didn't like it. And it's funny, like, I finally did that first book when I was 19. And that was a total game changer for me. So from a writing perspective, I was always someone who was bad at it and someone who didn't really like it that much. And I've kind of came through that. So I feel like that's why I'm able to talk to people and teach it on a much more basic level, because I've been there where either you feel like you're not good or it's just something that doesn't come naturally, and having to push through that and then being able to come to the other side and learning from it and getting a lot better.
Mm. So we'll just outline the 5 books that you have now, just so people know what kind of books you're writing.
Yeah. So the first one was called The Productive Person. So that was on productivity for entrepreneurs. Second one was Breaking Out of a Broken System. That was a charity project I did with my brother. He plays in a rock and roll band called Need to Breathe. So we did that book. That was 100% for charity. We did Productivity Hacks for Entrepreneurs. We did Book Launch, which is more teaching our process, and then How to Not Suck at Writing Your First Book, which is kind of a tongue-in-cheek. It related to my feelings, so I like wanted to reach specifically to that person who was like, I'm worried about this and I'm worried about really having trouble with this.
Yeah. And actually, it's quite funny because I don't really read print, but I have here Breaking Out of a Broken System. Here it is. And the reason I got it in print is because it's you and your brother did half each, right? And half of it's white on black and the other half is black on white, which makes it easier to read in print, basically. Yeah. But it's cool. I'm going to send it to some of my younger cousins because, you know, you guys, you know, young people. But what I really noticed in there by having a look at that, and also what you've just said, is and what you've done in the summit, I see you working smarter. I know you work hard, but you also work smarter. So, for example, you're not someone who's going to spend 4 years doing a master's in creative writing, are you? So just talk a bit about how working smarter, not harder, applies to the authors who are listening.
Yeah, so that's a huge, huge thing for us. And we're big on the 80-20 Pareto's principle. So getting things to 80% and then moving on. So big for me is getting that learning to 80% and then moving on. And continually pushing that. I mean, we also use a lot of Parkinson's law. So giving ourselves hard, strict deadlines that are short and challenging so that we push to get to that. But overall, it's, I feel like a lot of authors, they scatter themselves too much. So if myself or us in general have been accused of anything, it's being overly simplistic, but that's because we just want to distill it down. It's like the people, when they go to market their books, when they go to write, they're like, they want to hear all the tactics and they're going to test out all this stuff and they're going to make a Facebook page and a Twitter page and then they're going to make a site. And by the time you finally sell the book, you're so worn out because you've done a million different things that the book goes nowhere. So we always try to get it down and find, learn from the best. Learn from people like you and hear, hey, what's exactly what's working for you? And I'm not going to overthink this. I'm just going to do that and focus and double down. Like once it's working, really double down on exactly what's working and ignore those shiny objects as much as I can, being a complete ADD person. Try to ignore those and say, hey, this is what's working right now. I'm going to stick to this. And yeah, that's awesome. I'm going to write that on my pad, stick it in my pocket and save that for a rainy day because this is working and I want to stick to this.
Mm. So you mentioned the 80-20 principle there and you've written these 5 books, as I said. What was the 80%, like the biggest thing that got you from hating writing to writing 5 books?
I think it was taking the leap and doing the first one. So many people just overthink it. So, oh man, this will be a great example. So for our first book, Breaking Out of a Broken System, it's interesting. It was the first one we wrote, but the second one we put out. So it's always confusing to explain. It was the first book we wrote, and I learned from one of my mentors. He gave me a 3-step process, which was mind map the book, then outline it, then write it. So mind map, you brain dump, you get a piece of paper, and you just write down everything you can think of onto this piece of paper. You have an idea. You don't have to have a title. You just start drawing lines and stuff, and you get all these ideas. And normally what happens is, like this happened to me with my first one. I went from saying, I have no idea, or maybe like a book I could write 10 pages on, to, wow, I have so much to write about. And this happens every time. And then the second step of that is you start to outline it. So you start to pull common themes and categories, and you're like, oh, I can't talk about this, or this doesn't fit. And then you start to organize it, and then you write it. And that's what we used with the first book. And we repeated that process through every chapter. So my brother and I, we both super busy. So we said, hey, we don't want this to be a nagging side project that just goes on for 6 months and we never finish it. So we carved out a week and it was actually around Christmas time. And we just locked ourselves in the house and then we went to this cabin and we just wrote the first book in a week. And we used that mind map, outline, write process, not only to map the whole book as a whole and we had the big picture, but then we did it chapter by chapter. So we would say, all right, here's chapter number one. It's about how awesome Joanna Penn is. So we're going to mind map all. Okay, she's British. She has a great accent. She's super smart. She works really hard. She's cool.
Okay, like
so we're going to map out all these things and then say, okay, now organize it. So we'll spend 10 to 12 minutes mind mapping the topic. Then 10 to 12 minutes outlining it in order of how we want to talk about it. And then we would spend anywhere from 60 to 90 minutes writing it. And obviously we would come back later, but that helped us get there. And then the 80-20 of writing the book is finishing the first draft. Is you got to get to that finish line. And it doesn't matter how bad it is. There's just this psychological thing of, when you get to the end of the rough draft, it's like seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. And for the first time, you believe you can actually finish it. And then it doesn't matter how bad it is. You'll go back and fix it and do all the work you need to. But it seems a lot less daunting once you've gotten to that finish line.
Mm. And you mentioned the timings there. And I remember also for me, doing timed writing was the thing that started me off. Like, you can, if you sit down for, like, you know, like you say, 15 minutes even, and you can write something in 15 minutes, doesn't matter, you know. And like you say, if you have a plan, you can do it. So is that, it has timed writing, because you also say you're ADD, right? Has timed writing helped you do all this stuff? Do you time everything, I guess?
Very much so. And that's really helped. That helped with the first book, especially because we were on the clock. And so a buzzer went off at the end, and then we'd start it again, and then a buzzer went off. And then, you know, so it was really important. And then as you see that little clock ticking at the top of your screen, it creates some urgency. It's using Parkinson's law, we talked about a little bit earlier, which is an object will swell in proportion to the amount of time you give yourself to complete it. So you see that, and you see that ceiling, and it's amazing because you feel like you have this block, but then you see that clock ticking down, and without fail, those 90-minute chunks of writing, you get down to the last 15 minutes, and the pure pressure of it, you just start typing like a madman, and you get it done. So that's really helpful. And then even down to everyday life, like, use rescue time to track time, and then I just started using Toggle, which I've heard about for a long time, and that's more of, you have to manually do it by task. So, like, I've got it on right now, and it just helps you. So it helps, because as writers and as just productive people in general, like, switching costs is a big thing. Writing, then saying, oh, I want to look up this thing online to support this point. And then next thing you know, 45 minutes later, and you've still got 200 words and you're not back to your writing. So just the act of not only timing it, but also kind of tracking it, that'll really help come to front of mind, like, okay, how much time am I actually spending writing? Because is it that I'm a slow writer, or that I just get distracted too much? And usually it's the latter.
Mm. And I think this is useful for fiction and nonfiction. I don't want people to think it's just a nonfiction thing. It really is timed writing, like, number one tip, I think. One of the other things that I've really noticed about you is your confidence. And what's funny is it feels like you came out of nowhere into the space. But in reading some of your other books, you've been working hard as an entrepreneur for years. I mean, as a teenager, you won awards, right? Being a young entrepreneur and everything. But you talk about in Breaking Out, you talk about limiting beliefs and how to overcome them. And many authors who are listening suffer from chronic self-doubt around what we're doing, especially in the self-publishing space, because there's a lack of validation, really. You know, there's no agent or publisher saying, oh, you're amazing, you know, type of thing. So talk a bit about how you have got this confidence, where this came from, and what happens when you do hit the fear.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think the biggest thing is that I still feel that all the time, that fear. And it's like, no matter how hard you try, you still want some kind of validation for what you're doing. So it's like, for example, this recent summit, like, there was months of prep work where it's just like tech problems and figuring out this site and getting this speaker and then getting a speaker that said yes, that then turned it into a no. And it's just like, you run into these walls and you start to question, is what I'm doing actually making a difference? Is this going to even be good? Is anyone going to show up to this? Like, everybody has those doubts, right? But it's just continually chugging along. And then eventually you will get that validation. Like, when the summit came out, and I mean, we more than doubled our goal, which was a ridiculously high goal anyway. And it just was amazing. That's when it's all worth it. But in terms of building that confidence before you get to that validation, like, that's super important. And I think the best way to do that is just jump a little bit outside of your comfort zone, which I know sounds really cliche, but take on some challenges. Like, there's no way for you to get more confidence without getting more skills or without doing something that you previously thought was not possible. And if you're not willing to do that, and if you're not willing to fail, like, you have to be willing to fail, and fail a lot. I think the only reason I've had success is because I fail more than most anybody, right? You know, it's just fail, get up, fail, get up, fail, get up, fail, get up. So you have to be willing to step out of that. And in Breaking Out of a Broken System, we talk about this is one of the best things. We have amazing parents, and that book is just all about how awesome our parents are and how much stuff they taught us. But the big thing we talk about in there is this concept of many, many successes. So M-I-N-I, like, many as in small, and then many successes. So there's a lot of small successes. So growing up, it was like getting in scouts and then learning how to tie a knot, learning how to start a fire, take care of myself if I was ever stressed, like all these different little things that they taught us and continued to push us out there and said, hey, go play a sport, get better at that sport, learn how to play the drums. Like it was all these not non-business related things that once you start to see a little bit of result here and a little bit of result here from taking on these challenges and having these many successes, then it's like, okay, cool. What can I do next? And that's why I'm so passionate about this stuff is I feel like for a lot of people, that first book is a mini success. It doesn't matter if you sell 5 copies, 50 or 500, 5,000, like just getting that first one out is a mini success where you're like, whoa, I finally did something that worked. I have a tangible result. And money's coming in from it, and like I see light that I can go towards, and it's such a good feeling to finally get that. But you have to jump out and put yourself in that position to be able to make it happen.
Mm. And like you say, I think in the self-publishing space, like finishing a book is one thing, but then so much disappointment seems to come from the sales side. But you know, I'm sure you've seen this too. Like making your first $10 online. That can really change your life. And I think we can't forget that. Like people listening, you can't forget that making $10 from something that's not a paid job is amazing. And then if you can make 10, you can make 100, right? You can make 100,000. You know, that is, how long has that journey been for you? Like where you are now running a, you know, what I can tell is pretty big business now. You know, when was that first $10 that you made as an entrepreneur? Because it was a while ago, right?
Oh, yeah, man. The first $10 as an entrepreneur, gosh, that was probably 11 or 12 at scout camp selling my mom sent me with a bunch of snacks. Great mom. As any great mom does, right? She loads you down with snacks and drinks and just wants to make sure you're taken care of. And then my entrepreneur brain was like, all my friends want these snacks. I'm going to sell them and I'm going to eat a little less and have all these awesome knives and cool stuff. that was the dream, right? And so I remember that. And then it just continually leveling up. And in high school, I ran a landscaping business for my summer. And the goal was to get $5,000 for college. And I remember hitting that. And then hitting 10,000 and then hitting, you know, it was the best summer of my life. And I hired all my friends to come work with me. And it's like, I remember making $500 in a day. And suddenly an iPod was a half a day's work. Whereas I'd always looked at it as at least 2 weeks of a paycheck. And so then it just, when that first happens, it just totally changes your perception. And then fast forward to the first book. And I remember seeing it 80, 100, 170 copies a day. And that's when I was like, this isn't my mom and my grandma and my cousins and my friends buying this book. These are people all over the world that I have no clue. And I remember that was like a light bulb moment for me because there's a difference between, like you said, hard labor, landscaping, throwing down mulch, and working your butt off. There's a difference between that and just like in this case, I was snowboarding all day in the Swiss Alps in Austria. And I remember checking in. It was like, I made $400 yesterday and I was snowboarding. Like, how cool is that? Like this thing of passive income that I'd heard of, it's kind of mystical only through real estate. You know, I geeked out on all the Robert Kiyosaki books.
Yeah. I was like, we've read all the same thing.
I was, you and I have read all the same books. That was when the light was finally there. It was like, okay, this is possible. And then fast forward and it just keeps growing. But I think the important thing and the takeaway for a lot of listeners is you got to start somewhere and don't have number envy. You know, it's so easy to look at and see other people's success and then have a huge letdown when it happens. So I remember the best part of my first book is I had zero expectations. So if this sells 5 copies, awesome. And so when they were exceeded, I was really happy. But it's hard if you just put all this pressure, it just makes the whole process not fun and not enjoyable. So you got to start somewhere there.
And then I'm interested because you are such a serial entrepreneur and you've done all kinds of businesses and you know a lot of people in a lot of different businesses. Why did you pick self-publishing and books when it seems like you didn't come from a kind of book loving background originally?
Yeah, that's a great question. We had success with the first book, then we did another one, then I helped a friend with his, then I helped somebody else. And it was we kind of fell into it. Like the businesses we were doing at the time, they were struggling. And my bank account was just crashing on a one-way path to zero. I was just watching it. And I dropped out of school. And I'd ran successful businesses in the past, but I knew they weren't in areas I wanted to do it. So it was just trying to find that. And the business we were working on at the time was struggling, and people kept asking about this. Like they just kept asking, and how are you writing these books so quickly? How are the books so successful? How do you market them? You know, all these questions, I found myself like a broken record, just having the same conversation over and over again with different people, just because I wanted to help them. And then finally we looked at it and we're like, well, all these people, this is something people want to know. It's like, you know, you get smacked in the back of the head so many times before you turn around and look. And that was what happened, is finally we're just like, okay, this is something people want to learn about. We're obviously good at it, and we've done it a bunch of times. Like, let's keep doing this, and let's start teaching it and see where it goes. And then we sold the first program to see if there was any interest. And when there was a ton of interest, then we created it based on exactly what people wanted.
And this, I think this goes back to your candy thing, which I like, you know, that as a kid, selling the candy your mum gave you. This is the point. It's selling things that people actually want to eat and that are yummy and that, you know, they actually want. And which is why romance is the highest selling fiction genre, right? People want to eat romance. They really want it. And they want thrillers and they want sci-fi fantasy. They want, you know, there's certain things that people want, and they also want to learn. And I wondered about your opinion. I mean, my feeling is that we're in this sort of growing maker movement, that, you know, it used to be that people just watch TV, now they watch TV and make TV, you know, with YouTube videos. They used to just listen to music, now they make music too. They used to just look at photos, now they take photos, and we used to just read, and now we want to write. I mean, do you see that this fits into a bigger, you know, generational shift, I guess, into making?
That's a great point. And so many great examples behind that. I think it really is, because the barrier has decreased. Like the barrier to entry has decreased, and also, it's easier than ever. So, whereas people used to look at this as this high and mighty thing, like, oh, to write a book, you must be a genius, you know, or to make music, you must just be an amazing musician, or to like you said, record videos, you must have an amazing camera. Whereas iPhone, hello, you know, that's why everyone's doing this number right here.
And making loads of money.
Exactly, right? So I think it's one, the barrier to entry is so much lower, but then people see the value in it, and they see that, hey, I can be a creator. And there's less of people preaching down and saying you can't, and there's more people like us saying, no, you actually can, and here's how to do it. So that's what I love, is empowering people, because if you're not creating,
you're just consuming, and what's the point?
Yeah, exactly. And I want to be brash and say, like, if you're not creating, why are you here? Like, you know, you're just taking up space. Like there's got to be something that can live longer than you do, right? And the essence of creating is like this book, this song, this YouTube video. It'll be on a shelf. It'll be somewhere like long after I'm off of this earth. That's how I can leave my legacy. And that's how I can keep living on. So, and the only way to do that is by creating something.
Mm. And also it's fun. Like, you know, I was on an interview earlier and, you know, and I said, actually what's fun is creating. I mean, you consume stuff and then you create stuff. Like you learn, you read a book, like we read lots of books, and then you create something from it. So it's fun as well. Like the life you live is more fun when you create stuff and help people. And also, as you said, you only need to be one rung ahead. Like, I love the fact that you're just teaching people and you're not, you know, 65 years old with this massive history behind you. You know, you're like, yeah, I've just done this and now I'm going to teach other people. I think that's fantastic. But anyway.
Can I touch on that real quick?
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm very passionate about this, that the best people to learn are people who are two rungs ahead of you. It's for me, it's so hard a lot of times to learn from someone who's 50 rungs ahead of me, because they can't relate. And when I ask them a question that I need help with, they can't answer it. So that's why I love, you know, learning from people who are just two steps ahead of me so that they can say, oh yeah, cool. I just did this 6 months ago. Here's what you don't want to do. Here's a mistake I made. Here's the provider you want to use. Here's how you want to sell these books. You don't like email campaign. You don't want to use this provider. You're going to use this. And it's like, they can save you so much time. And that's why I love doing that so much more than someone who's way ahead, because I've done the other route and it's kind of disappointing sometimes when they're like, oh yeah, I just have somebody on my team handle that. Or, oh yeah, I just have, you know, Google that. I don't know. I'm so far removed from that. It's like, well, that doesn't help me right now. And I just keep trying to level up and like, okay, cool. They're two spaces ahead of me. Then I'd catch them. And then it's like, all right, cool. Now who's the next person?
Who's the next person?
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, so it's great there. You're talking about learning from other people. And you just, I mean, I've listened to a number of the summit interviews, which are brilliant. And I learned loads from them. But you sat through them all. Like, there are, what, 40-odd hours of yes. interviews? Like, so I really wondered, what were the top three things that you learned from all of these different people listening? Because obviously we're always learning new stuff. What really stood out for you? And obviously you're at a different level to various people listening, but what was interesting?
Yeah. Oh man, there were so many great things. The top things I would say, first would be, you have to have a back end. This is something that we teach and I'm a big proponent of, but just hearing it over and over again, like the people who were really successful, they had a really dialed in back end. A lot of times that was the reason that they weren't going the published route, is because then they lost control of their back end. So Ryan Dice talked about that. Russell Brunson talked about that. I think Michael Port, Nick Unsworth, Jamie Tardy, she did go the published route. Like, but there's a lot of people who were just talking about that, where they write the book with the back end in mind and what's next and how do I use this to build my business. And it's the people with ridiculous numbers. They all knew that, yeah, the book is awesome and it's a tool to get people here. But the big stressor there too is, so many people just say, oh cool, well, if the book isn't the main thing, I'm just gonna write the book in like 2 hours. It's going to suck. And then I'm just going to put it out there. And that was very important, is all those people said, no, this has to be your best stuff. Even though you're focusing on the back end, the book has to be your best stuff. And you lead with your best. And you don't, it's not a 200 page sales pitch. It's actually good stuff and it's soft on the sales. So that was a big, big learning point.
Just before you go on, just explain what back end means to people who might not understand that concept.
Absolutely. So it's the other actions that people are going to take, or the other things that people are going to buy once they get your book. So for nonfiction, it might be coaching. It might be a program. It might be community. Yeah, software. It could be your local business. It could be real estate agent to sell more houses, you know, all these different things. And for fiction, it could be your community of your raving fans. It could be other fiction books. It could be the next books in the series. It could, you know, like there's a lot of different things it could be, but focusing on that back end.
Great. Fantastic. So basically things that, you know, the book might cost $5, but the back end products are higher price. So you can, from a business perspective, make more income from a customer, but by giving them something brilliant.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And something they would love. And also, like nonfiction, it could be behind the scenes videos. It could be, you know, extra stuff about the characters and, you know, just all these different things. Like, people always want to that extra layer and the behind the scenes, and they want to see how it was made. They want to know more. You know, there's all kinds of stuff you can give them for that.
Mm. And actually, Russell Brunson's interview was great. And his book is .com Secrets. It's fantastic.
When did you read it?
About a month ago. and then I listened to the interview that you did with him, and he is like, I know all that stuff, right? We've read loads of books on that stuff, but that book just puts it in a process that makes it so. I've given that book to loads of people now.
Yeah. Oh.
And the interview was super good too. And his back end with the software, you know, superb. And his webinar stuff. And I mean, I fell right into his, you know, I went to have a look at his website and fell right into his back end.
Did you buy the perfect webinar?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. So this is hilarious. This is how good he is. Within 20 minutes of our interview finishing, I'd bought, I think, $300 worth of his product. And I went straight into the Perfect Webinar. Yeah. I bought that. I bought the upsell.
Yeah, me too.
And then I immediately used it all. Mm. And I've already made a ton of money from it.
Yeah. And it's very good as well.
Good.
He's a great salesman. But what was so good in the interview you did with him, and I'll link to all this in the show notes, he says, go and get the free chart, right? So you go and get the free chart, and then it's the free plus shipping. And then, it's super, super duper.
The order form bump, the, yeah. the one-time offer. Yeah.
Absolutely. It's so brilliant. Good. So anybody who wants to get deep into this, like .com secrets, the interview on the summit, absolutely brilliant. Anyway, back to what you learned. What else was on your list?
So I've got a couple more things. And real quick, I love how I just finished that book last week. Mm. You finished it month ago. Like every time we talk, we figure out that we've just recently read the same exact book. So we've got a shared reading list at some point. but the other two big learnings from the summit is the importance of pre-sales and how to get them. So a lot was stressed on that. That's something I haven't really put a lot of thought into and haven't really done very well in the past. So I loved learning about that and learning about the different ways people drove pre-sales and whether it was Russell Brunson, whether it was Ryan Dice, doing free plus shipping offers, doing packages, just all those different things and how that really helped people get high on the charts. And then the third thing was, and this is pretty simplistic, but I think this will be encouraging, to people listening is the discipline and consistency that people showed and that they preached. What we see a lot of times is the tip of the iceberg. So it's this massive success. And what you don't see is the 90% of that iceberg that's below the surface that they've been plugging away and they've been consistently putting things out and they didn't have a smash hit on the first one. They probably didn't have a smash hit on the second one. A lot of them, they didn't have a smash hit on the third, fourth, and fifth. You know, it's the discipline that they engaged in and how seriously they took it and how they just consistently churned things out even when the validation wasn't there. So we talked about this earlier, the validation and how that's what spurs people on. But the common theme was that none of these people needed validation to keep going. They just kept going until the validation eventually came. And at that point, it was like, oh, cool, awesome. People recognize what I'm doing. I'm going to keep going because I wasn't doing this for the validation to begin with. And all those people, they were long-term successes. They weren't just, you know, like Hal Elrod says it takes 10 or 12 years to become an overnight success. Yeah. And that's so true, right? All these people have been plugging away and they're putting in their 10,000 hours. So I think that was a great underlining message that can be really encouraging for people, especially just getting started, is, hey, you haven't put in your time yet. You know, it's not everyone's looking for the shortcut and the tip and the secret and all that, but you got to put in your time and you might get there, you know, by working smarter than harder, tying this full circle to earlier, you're going to get there faster, but still you got to be disciplined and you got to be consistent.
Yeah. And it's interesting. The pre-sales thing is fascinating because, of course, Amazon now gives indies pre-sales on books, which we only got last year. And iBooks has been doing for a while. So's Kobo, so's Nook. And I think many authors worry about it because you don't get the ranking boost on Amazon. You get it double time on iBooks. But I think the pre-sales idea is something that indies have to get much more into. So what was the biggest thing on pre-sales? I know you're mainly talking about courses, but for book pre-sales, for example, and you did for the summit, what was your sort of best way of getting pre-sales?
Yeah. So biggest takeaways from the summit was, it was packaging an offer so that's so irresistible that they get way more than they pay for. So that how that applies to books, that's what everyone did, right? Like Russell Brunson was giving away free stuff. Ryan Dice was giving away free stuff. It was generally free offer plus shipping, and they used the back end to liquidate that offer. So I remember Russell saying it was like $32. They made $32 per
audiobook.
Free book. Yeah, it was $37 for audiobook, but like $32 was the average value of the customer that got a free book. Mm. So they were making money on people who were getting free books, and that's how they were able to do that. And as an author, our biggest goal is to get the books in as many hands as possible, right? So that just helps to do that. And then for the summit, we did that ahead of time by offering bonuses. We offered a price discount. So that was, you know, an early bird discount that they could get, and also scratching that itch of immediate access. So I'd pre-recorded a lot of the interviews. So said, hey, summit doesn't start for a couple weeks, but if you want to get pre-access to a lot of these speeches, you can start just going through them and learning. Then go ahead and get the all access pass right now. So that's how we did the pre-sales for the summit.
Mm. And I mean, I'm right today as we record this, I'm doing pre-sales on Deviance, my latest novel, and I've put the price down for the pre-sales period and using awesome. The email list to sell to people who are already on the list mm-hmm. at a cheaper price. It's difficult to do too much with a fiction, with a novel, but with nonfiction, I think there's so much more flexibility because people will pay for information more than they will pay for entertainment.
Absolutely.
Right. So just a couple more questions. I wanted to also ask you about ambition, because I'm trying to bring this up a lot more. I'm ambitious. I know you're ambitious, but ambition and making really good money, you know, being a six-figure author now, to me, it's more like, what about being a seven-figure author, eight-figure author, of which, you know, many of the people you interviewed are doing that. So, you know, I guess, how do you feel about ambition, and how do you think people, you know, listening should kind of claim that ambition and just ignore what other people say?
Oh man, it's tough, because I can easily be accused of being a workaholic.
Oh, me too.
You know, but it's a big part of my ambition is wanting to grow and wanting to learn. And money doesn't drive a lot of that. Money's just the byproduct of that. It just happens because I love what I do and because I want to grow. And so I've always been, this is kind of like we were talking about earlier, I've always been in the camp of, like, if you're not learning, you're dying. Like, if you're not growing, you're dying. Like, if you're not getting better, you're getting worse. And I hate that feeling of just being like, all right, cool, I'm just going to ride this one out. Like, life's good. I have a job that I kind of hate and a decently nice car and a house in an okay neighborhood. Let's just cash this in, and in 30 years I'm going to die. Like, what? That's so crazy. So ambition for me is growing and helping other people and leaving an impact, and it's consistently driving towards that. So just continually focusing on growth and helping other people. And it's something that I don't know, you can cultivate it somewhat, but some of it's deep down. And mm-hmm. if you're willing to just put up with mediocrity, then it's going to happen, and it's going to keep perpetuating mediocrity. So I think it's super important. And the core of that is not caring about the validation. Like, the best artists, the best authors, the best musicians, it's the validation doesn't matter. It's this, because this is what I love, and I'm going to do it, and I'm going to be better. And like you said, the seven figure, like, we're gunning hard for that right now. And it's just, it's just a representation of what we can achieve. And by reaching that, we're going to be able to help X amount of people. Mm. And then by leveling that up, the amount of impact we can have, the amount of ads money we can spend on ads, the amount of people we can get in front of. Like, I feel like a lot of people, they have these negative beliefs on money. So they look at the profit and the margin, the money you make, and they want to be the opposite. They're like, well, that's, if that person's selling stuff and doing well, they must be a bad person. And I'm not going to compromise my beliefs to sell stuff. And like, they have so many negative attachments to this, but I think when you start looking at it the different way, like, I have to sell someone on my book, because if they don't get this book, their life's not going to be better because I believe in this information. Or I have to make a profit, because it's that profit and that margin that allows me to hire better employees, that allows me to help more people, that it allows me to invest more money in my product, make a better product. Like, all those things are drivers, not just this thing that you make because you're a bad person, right? Like, so many people have that just backwards. So I think it's kind of swapping that ambition along with swapping your belief of, like, when that stuff comes, not repelling it. Because a lot of people have money repellent, right? Mm. they sprayed themselves with money repellent and success repellent so that when it comes, they're like, oh, no, 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 no. I don't want my friends to think I'm better than them. I don't want my family to think I'm a know-it-all. I don't want, you know, it's like you have to get past that.
And I like Peter Diamandis. You know, I'm sure you've read Abundance and Bold, right? Really brilliant book. You haven't?
Actually, not yet.
Oh, you've got to do that. Got to do that. Well, in there, he says, if you want to be a billionaire, serve a billion people. And that really helped me. And it's what you're saying. It's like, and the same with the candy right at the beginning. If you serve your market, that's the way you're going to make good money and success in all the ways that you talk about. And yeah, I mean, that's what you're doing with the summit and the self-publishing school. That's what I try and do at the Creative Pen. By serving the market, you will, that naturally brings good things and makes you happy at the same time. So you have to read that book by the next time we speak. Okay. And everyone listening, Abundance by Peter Diamandis, must read.
Awesome.
Right. Just last question before we finish up. So as a millennial, one of the episodes I just had was about the future of publishing, and we're talking about the next sort of couple of years, 5 years of the publishing market. Now, as a millennial, what do you see in the next 5 years in the publishing space, internet space? You know, what is the next frontier?
Yeah, I think it's being decentralized, and where there's so many common themes, whether it's books, whether it's music, whether it's documentaries and movies, like it's the exact same. And like my brother's in music, so I know a lot about the back end of the music industry and record labels and management and how all that stuff works. And I see the exact same things happening between the two industries. So I think it's coming back down to where the artist is going to become king. It's more independent, indie, whether it's record labels, indie publishers, all those things. And then also the publishers and or the promoters are becoming really, really important. So the only power that publishers have now is distribution. The only power that record labels have is radio play. There's like some old antiquated things that they're still holding on like by a straw. But as those things begin to fade away, you see people like Live Nation in the music industry. They own concert venues and they're promoters, and people don't need a record deal to be successful. In self-publishing, you don't need a publisher to be successful. And so I see all that kind of decentralizing. And then our goal, big, hairy, audacious goal with self-publishing school is to kind of put the publishers out of business and to show people that self-publishing is not only a viable option, but it's the best option, and it's a great option. And we're not there yet, obviously, but that's where we're moving towards. And the power becomes to where maybe it's the independent publishers at that time, where they're not necessarily, quote, like publishers in the traditional sense, but like the power is shifted to where, if you listen to any of these summit interviews, I mean, you know this, Janet, it's the publisher's not going to move books. You still have to move books. So it's already shifted so much more to where it's the final straws, and it'll keep moving that direction. But that's where I see it moving, to where the power comes back into the artist's hands. And also there will be a new level. It's like, instead of the publishers being way up here, the artists and the authors being way down here, there's gonna be a new level where there's less margin. The artists make more, but it's a different model of promotion. So that's my personal opinion.
Yeah, no, fantastic. And I'm a closet millennial. I figure I just a little older, but I behave like one. So fantastic. So where can people find you and all your good stuff online?
Yeah, absolutely. So self-publishingschool.com is the best place to go. That's where I have like free training videos and stuff like that. Or you can find me on Facebook. Yeah, that's pretty much it.
You're not a big Twitter guy, are you?
I'm not. You know, you're more of a millennial than I am, Joanna. I'm an old school Facebook guy, and I'm not even on there a ton. You know,
you're just doing the work. That's what
exactly.
You're doing.
That's it. I try to eliminate as many distractions as possible. So.
Brilliant. Well, thanks so much for your time, Chandler. That was amazing.
No problem. Thank you for having me, Joanna.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.